Well, I'm waiting for the
Love
lady.
Talk Radio.
Sometimes she comes on real quick, sometimes not. Tonight we're going to expand your wisdom on how to communicate with each other with Dennis Gianetti, and he's a life coach, mastery life coach, business strategist, divorce prevention, and relationship education wellness coaching. Dennis is the chief learning consultant for Illustrated Properties and a breakthrough specialist in the area of personal development. Dennis uses the principles of Robbins and mundane training in RMT and strategic intervention coaching, human need psychology to help clients create the life conditions that match the personal blueprint they have envisioned for their ideal life. These principles and strategies are tried and true and are used by the world-renowned coach, trainer, strategist, and leadership consultant Anthony Robbins. Many of Dennis's clients, whether they feel stagnant or want more out of life, are looking to break through to the next level of their life or business. And you can go to Dennis's website and you can see a lot of things. And I will give, and also the website is www.life-camp.com. And I want, without any further ado, I want to welcome Dennis to the show. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate the invitation tonight and
well,
that wonderful introduction.
Well, thank you. And also, but Dennis, when I was reading this, there's something when I started signing, when I started posting your show, something that really stuck in my mind is divorce prevention. And I'd like to start
right.
asking you, if people learned how to communicate, would that really, that would really cut the divorce rate significantly, wouldn't it?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. We kind of make a little joke about it sometimes. And we'll say when people get married, we say, will you take this person for better or worse? And it would always be interesting if at that very moment someone said, well, when you say worse, what do you mean? And, you know, we say that tongue-in-cheek, but in reality, it's a lack of definition and clarity about what we want and also about what the other person wants and expects from themselves and from the relationship. And sometimes we come into, as we say, the relationship with a movie in our head, with a role for the other person that we never really get to tell them. So communication in terms of where the relationship goes from the very beginning starts with all the predetermined thoughts, beliefs, rules, and expectations that have been imprinted on us throughout our entire life. Now, generally speaking, we like to think it's simpler than that, and it's just a matter of you're attracted to someone, you have things in common, and all of a sudden things are going to be wonderful. But at the end of the day, it's being able to have an honest conversation with ourselves about who we are and what we want and sharing that with somebody else that you can grow together. Then it comes down to the communication skills as well. So right off the bat, we're starting at a disadvantage because we're not clearly and fully aware of what it is that we're looking for, just what we want to feel. And as a result of that, as time goes on and we don't have those feelings anymore, what we find is that we start to disassociate or draw away from the person that we're in a relationship with. So it's fascinating in a way to observe in coaching sessions with couples and sometimes in generalized relationships that are not intimate in nature and watch these patterns take place. And as they do, you can start to see where a person is or a couple is at any particular point in the relationship, and you can almost predict with some level of certainty what's going to happen next.
And, you know, that's true, but you said something in there. When we go into marriage, are we going in to have a relationship, or are we going in trying to make the change the person to be like us?
Well, you know,
I know when I got married a long time ago, that happened.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's been research out there that indicates, and this is a little deep, and there's some definite rationalization to it, but there's some research that indicates that people actually get into relationships and they find people that are there to help them heal the pain that they've experienced in the past. Now, again, that's a whole other level of deep because we're literally saying that the subconscious is looking for someone who represents pain they've had in the past or pain that was caused to them in the past by a particular person. And to put a little bit of a humorous spin on it, we might say, for example, when a man meets a woman who he feels like he's falling in love with, he says, boy, if she never changes, I'll be as happy as pie. And the woman meets that same guy and says, boy, with just a few changes, he'll be perfect. And the problem is, as they grow in the relationship, usually apart, the man doesn't change, and the woman does. And that's not, of course, finite. I mean, of course, they'll change a little bit. But what the woman was looking for, which is for the guy to change more, doesn't happen. What the guy was looking for, which is for the woman to not change, doesn't happen either. And so they get confused. You know, they don't understand why it's not working out. They want it to work out. And the fact of the matter is they didn't explain these rules and these expectations to each other right from the beginning. But if I could just take a minute, I'm going to tell you about a life cycle of any relationship that can really put this in perspective. When people first meet, what they're looking for more than anything else is variety. This goes into six human needs psychology, looking for variety, and they're looking for significance. They want to have fun. They want to feel good, and they want to feel important. So they meet somebody. Now, the significance they can get from a relationship can be being someone who they find attractive and they think other people will find attractive. It could be with being with someone who treats them very special, especially in the beginning. And that's always an interesting thing because, as Chris Rock had once said, when you first meet someone, you don't actually meet them, you meet their representative. And that means you're on your best behavior, of course, when you first meet somebody. But the reality is, for most people, they do want to have fun. They want that new feeling, that new experience, that first kiss, that first I love you, all that kind of stuff. And they also want to feel important. But as time goes on and the relationship grows, that need for fun and that need for significance is still there, but some other needs come into play. You start to have feelings, and you start to have a need for connection and a need for love. And that's one of the most vulnerable times in a relationship, that person that says, I love you first, taking a huge risk and wondering, will that other person say it back? So you can see all the mixed emotions, having fun, wanting to feel important, all of a sudden wanting that connection on a deeper level, feeling vulnerable, taking a risk, putting it out there. And then at the same time, when they do get that connection and they get the I love you back, guess what happens? They start to want certainty. They start to want to know, okay, we've had fun, I feel important, and we love each other. Now, don't leave me. What do I got to do to make this a commitment? What do I got to do to make this, you know, mine? How do I control this from getting out of hand so that it's always this way? And then that's where the relationship is at a make or break point, because you're always going to have fun in the beginning. You're always going to feel important in a good part of the beginning of the relationship, and you may even fall in love. But when you get to that point where certainty becomes an issue, then any little thing can break it apart. Any little doubt, any little insecurity, any little nervousness, a lack of communication in that context can break it apart, or at least start to break it apart. And so now all of a sudden certainty is there. Now if you get certainty, the relationship stays nice and calm and everything's working out good. But if you don't have that certainty and you start having that doubt, you start challenging them. You start creating drama. You start creating conflict. And now it's not fun anymore. And you certainly don't feel important anymore. And then that connection starts to dissipate. So if you really follow that, the need to have variety and fun, the need to be important, the need to feel loved and connected, and the need for certainty, every relationship, and by the way, this can apply to jobs and this can apply to projects that you work on and any relationship that you have that's new, but an intimate relationship specifically, any relationship goes through those four cycles. And then what happens is that when it gets to that point and now you're not sure if it's working or not, all that stuff starts to fall apart. If you can maintain a certainty that, hey, we're definitely going to have fun, we're definitely going to go out there and connect and feel important to each other, it never ends. I mean, think about it. When you really think about it, how many people do you know in a relationship said, whew, man, we always have fun. He or she makes me feel so important. We love each other so much, and I know they'll never hurt me. I'm going to get rid of this person. It'll never happen because that's what everybody wants, but that's not what everybody gets.
You know, the valleys, you know, this is something, you know, everybody wants to go through the personal growth, but you're going to go into the deepest valleys to go to the highest mountains to look at the ocean. of your oceans of opulence before you see the light. Do you feel that, Dennis? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's an old African proverb that says, if there's no enemy within, the enemy on the outside can do us no harm. And people don't understand that the pain sometimes that they go through or the challenges, they're not, I mean, certainly it hurts, but what they really are more than anything is the test. They're lessons and they're tests. They're there to teach us something, but more importantly, I believe it's God's way. I do believe that pain is God's way of testing you to see if you're ready to go to the next level of your life. If people don't understand the lesson that comes with pain in their relationships and in their personal growth, then they're not ready for the next level. And that's just something that many people have to go through that they don't grab onto. They don't understand that there's challenge in everything worthwhile. But most people, they see a challenge and they say, why me? Most people see pain and they go, oh, I'm going to avoid that. I got to stay away from that. And they don't understand that when they're making such decisions, and this is the hard part here, they're actually creating a neuroplasticity in their mind. They're actually hardwiring their brain to say, I'm going to settle, that I'm good enough just where I am, that it's not worth taking risks, that this means pain or that means pain. And that's just not true. It's just what they're buying into in their response to those challenges and that pain. They're not taking the moment to say, wait a minute, you know, I have the faith that I've been put here for a reason. These challenges are put in front of me for a reason. How can I use this? How can I use this experience to make my life better? And that includes the relationships that people are in and learning about each other and taking the time to realize, hey, wait a minute, I need to learn about myself through this fight. When I'm having a conflict with my spouse, when I'm having a relationship issue with someone close to me, or even at work, how can I learn this? How can I learn from this? How can I use this so that I can create what I call collaborative, achievement-focused relationships where you're working together to achieve a common goal?
And that's very true. And see, something that I've learned to go to success and wealth and everything you want starts with anger and frustration. Because you got to fissure it. And what that anger does is go deep inside. And see, something that I expanded into, Dennis, is I don't look at pain as pain. I look at it as the world trying to show me that I have the courage to expand through the situation.
Definitely.
And see, that's where... And Dennis, this is what really brings on this question. How is the world willing to change, but they're really afraid to expand out of their current situation?
Well, see, this is really an eternal question that's probably been, you know, at least pondered or asked or dealt with by people, you know, the history of human civilization. And the thing is, it goes back to that fight or flight instinct that we all have, that survival mechanism. And, you know, it was ingrained in us. It's in our DNA so that when we come up to a – when we're a cavemen, cavewomen, we come up to a bush and that little instinct goes off and we say, okay, there's a saber-toothed tiger there. You know, I could be dinner. And the flight instinct kicks off, I'm running away. Or I get to that bush and that saber-toothed tiger is there and I think, okay, this can be my dinner. And you got the flight instinct. As we became, quote-unquote, more civilized, we don't have the need for that. Level of violence or that need or the propensity to prepare for violence on a physical level while the adrenaline kicks in and we can protect ourselves or go after our dinner. So as we become more civilized and in relationships, that instinct doesn't go away. And so we end up putting ourselves in situations where we feel that emotion, but we repress it. Or we feel that emotion and we project it elsewhere and in other ways. And we don't deal with the real issues. So we can't grow and we can't get ourselves to another level because we're not dealing with our basic need and instinct to fight for what we want, particularly if we don't know what we want, or we run away from it so often that we never get a chance to deal with it. So, I mean, for the most part, people can grow when they embrace and acknowledge what they're feeling as action signals. If I'm angry, it's because something is bothering me. Sounds obvious, but how many people take it to the next level and say, well, what is bothering me? Why is it bothering me? Does this always bother me? You know, is it when one person does it? So is it really about the thing that's happening, or is it about many things that are happening with that person? They don't take the time to really sit back and reflect upon what's really going on. Usually it's just files and files and files of experiences repressed or avoided that eventually get them to the point where they're ready to explode. And then at some point they do, and then the person who's the victim of that unfortunate circumstance responds in kind.
And that's very true, but something I really wanted to ask you, Dennis, in relationships, how is people's relationships mirroring their parents' relationships?
Oh, well, in a lot of ways. I mean, for one thing, usually a child is mimicking at some level one of the parents in their future relationships. And it doesn't have to be the girl mimicking the mom or the boy mimicking the dad. It's very possible that it can be, you know, the boy mimicking the mom, the girl mimicking the dad, or some variety of both. So no matter, you know, how we try to wash it, at the end of the day, people are going to have some of their mother or father or dominant levels of their mother and father in them. And part of that is how the mom and dad treated each other and what kind of model or benchmark they provided for that person. And it's going to be predicated on the level of pain or pleasure that they associated with that experience. So if they saw the mom in pain based on the dad, for example, perhaps treating the mother with what might be deemed as disrespect, whatever that might be to certain people, and they saw the mom was sad or the mom was depressed, they're going to look at that and they're going to say, okay, one of two things are going to come out of this. Number one, I'll never treat somebody like that. I'll never treat my wife like that because I don't like the fact that my mom is sad. I don't like the fact that my mom is depressed, and I'm not happy that my father is doing that, but I'll never do that. That's number one. That's a positive outcome to a certain extent in the future of that person's relationship. But they can also look and say, if I'm bullyish enough, if I'm aggressive enough, I can get my spouse to do what I want. So the experience can be conjured two different ways, depending on how that child growing up looks at the experience and says, this is pleasure, this is pain. Bullies, for example, in school, they're people and their children who basically prey upon other children for the purposes of feeling good about themselves. It almost has nothing to do with physical intent as much as it does emotional need. They feel small on the inside, so they pick on people who are smaller on the outside. But at the end of the day, what they're really looking for is attention, love, connection, and they're not getting that typically from the home. Or they're being ignored. So they're either being ignored, they're being admonished, they're being bullied in some capacity at home, so they bring it to school. So the children of today and all throughout history, at one level or another, they're mimicking what they see, and it either means pain or it means pleasure. And I know you know this phrase, people will avoid pain at a greater length than they will pursue pleasure. People will not pursue personal growth and the possibility of having more if it means doing things that they feel will cause them rejection or cause them to feel like they're not enough or cause them to feel like they failed.
But Dennis, when you said rejection, this question came to me. How do we get people to understand the one they're rejecting is their own self?
Well, believe it.
Their own inner grander.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it's as simple as that, and to realize that no one can actually reject you. I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. You have to give a person permission to make you feel inferior. Rejection is really a reflection on how you feel about yourself. Because it's not really personal. If you're in sales, for example, and I teach a lot of salespeople, if you're in sales and you make a call and someone says, no, thank you, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting the opportunity. If you're in a relationship, let me take that back. If you're not in a relationship and you'd like to be in a relationship and you approach someone and you ask them out and they say, no, I'm not interested, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting the opportunity. They're rejecting their readiness to be in a relationship at that point with someone who they are judging at that point is not sufficient for them. And it sounds horrible, but it really isn't. It really isn't, because there should be more confidence coming from walking up and taking the chance to create an opportunity for yourself than to worry about if it doesn't happen, because at the end of the day, you're not any worse off than when you started. I remember many years ago, I had a friend came to me and said, oh, I want to ask this young lady out. I go, why don't you ask her out? And she said, we were out at a restaurant bar scenario. And he says, well, I don't want to ask her out. I go, why not? He says, well, she might say no. And I go, how is it any worse than you staring at her all night like a stalker from across the bar? And the point being, it's like, you know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, if we make that call, if we ask that question, if we just pursue that dream and it doesn't work, guess what? So what? Do it again. It's just a not yet, not a no. But the problem for most people is that would rather sit there with the hope and the possibility that it could happen someday than the actual attempt to make it happen someday. Because when they try to make it happen and if it doesn't work, they take that as validation that they never can rather than a lesson to get them closer to where they want to be.
And that's very true. But when somebody did that, and everybody's done it, I know I have, how are you setting the energy up to get a no before you even ask the question?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I mean, your disposition, your energy flow from the very beginning is, whether people realize it or not, it's almost like an aroma. I mean, when you there's actually a great story about a gentleman who was bidding for a $10 million project with the city council, and his friend was in the city, and he saw the bid. He was like, yours is the best by far. And they said, fantastic. You know, this means we're going to get it. He goes, well, you got to present it. He goes, okay. And he wasn't very happy with his presentation skills, and he's very nervous. So he goes and he gives the presentation, and he's sweating, and he's nervous, and it doesn't go very well. And long story short, he doesn't get the bid. He goes to his friend, and he says, I don't understand. You said I had the best bid. He goes, you did, but no one's given $10 million to someone who doesn't believe in themselves. And, you know, whether it's $10 million or a date or even just the confidence to ask for your money back, you know, people have to realize that you literally put off that energy right from the beginning. If you don't believe it, why should they? If you don't have faith in the outcome, why should they? You know, and people are just hoping. And I always say hope is kind of the purgatory between success and failure. It's where you go when you don't want to go down, but you're afraid to go up. So you have that hope, and you hang on to the hope. But the hope creates an inaction. And what happens is people get so caught up in that, they begin to believe that it'll never be possible. And because they never believe it'll be possible, even when they take that step, it only takes the smallest, this tiniest microcosm of rejection for them to go, oh, see, I told you. I knew this wasn't going to work out. And they don't realize that whether you want to call it the reticular activating system, whether you want to call it quantum physics, however you want to look at it, at the end of the day, we put it out there and we get back exactly what we expected.
And that's very true. And Dennis's website is life-camp.com. And Dennis, do you have any camps coming up next year that you know of?
Any events and things like that in camps? Well,
yeah.
Life Camp is interesting. We actually do Life Camp once a year, usually towards the end of the year, but we have people continue on with programs that we do, which we're going to be launching one in January. So if they go to the website and they look in January, they're definitely going to see some things that are going on in terms of the different opportunities to get into the Life Camp community. So we're excited about that. And then in addition to that, we are running some local events in January, and then we're going to have some online things also coming up in late January, early February. So that's what I would urge people to take a peek at and go to the website probably, I'd say, beginning to middle of January, and you're going to see a lot of stuff up there for people not only in Florida, where I happen to live, but also across the country through our online programs and resources.
And I want to ask you about this because people ain't going to understand it. Certified Ninja Coach, what would that mean to somebody if they was going to call you?
Well, I have a very diverse background, and the ninja part of it actually comes from Fort Collins, Colorado, a gentleman by the name of Larry Kendall, brilliant, brilliant man, was running a company called The Group, and he's still involved with them in Fort Collins, and they were like one of the number one real estate companies in that whole area, and they had this system called the Ninja Selling System, which was actually created off of a gentleman by the name of Jim Dunlap, who used to bring deals consistently at night and put them on the broker's desk, and no one ever see him, so they call him the ninja. So Larry had the foresight to say, okay, well, this is interesting. So he kind of looked at what Jimmy did, and he kind of looked at what other top producing agents were doing, and then he kind of connected that with personal development and sales tools from the past and present and what is now the future. And he actually created a system that was field and tested and proven called the Ninja Selling System. So I had gone out there, and I was just so impressed, and I work with real estate agents and salespeople all the time, and I asked to become part of that organization And so they made me a certified instructor and a certified coach in the Ninja Selling System. So it serves me very, very well because it's very business-oriented, but it also connects people to their personal side, which then ties very well into the relationship coaching and the life coaching and all the things that I do. And what's interesting about it is one of the books that they use in the Ninja Selling System is Bob Berg's Go Giver and Go Giver Sells More. And Bob was just at our life camp. And Bob and I are talking about, you know, the future and different things. He's got a great new book called Adversaries to Allies Out. And we're, you know, talking about doing a training program potentially with that. And then one other thing in addition to that, I was able to work with what's called Robbins Madonis Training and get a coach certification through them, which helped me understand the six human needs and neuroassociative conditioning. So what's happening is, you know, I've been able to take the Ninja Selling System, work with salespeople, and then really be able to then parlay the sales skills and the business skills and identify and understand when people have personal things going on, which, by the way, as you well know, is 75 to 80% of the time. And so now we're in a situation, no matter what's going on in the coaching session, whether it's a marriage issue, whether it's a confidence issue, whether it's a skills issue, whether it's a strategic planning issue, we're able to deal with all of it at any given time spontaneously or as a strategy planned and ready to go in any coaching session because of it.
You know, the first time I heard this statement, I laughed. You will grow personally before you grow financially. And I went, ha, ha, ha. Now it's going, ha, ha, back at me. Because you will grow personally before you make $1.
Yeah,
you're
going to
have...
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. I forget the name of the person that said the quote, but I saw a quote the other day and it moved me. And what it said was, and you know, and money is great, but this is the quote, okay? And it was just, it's so powerful. It said, it's great the things that money can buy, but it is also great not to lose those things that money cannot. And I think that's what people really need to understand is that who you are as a person, the relationships that you have, confidence, your faith, all of that, those are things money can't buy. So while it's great to have money and to be able to buy things and have choices, the things that money can't buy are what's really, truly powerful. And when you can assimilate into that, when you can really envelop and grasp into that power, into that reality of the universe and of God and of all the things that you believe in that go well far beyond who we simply are as a physical presence, then things find their way back into your life or into your life as it may be. And that's when more confidence comes, a fear of rejection comes, all of that.
You know, here's the thing. You can take all the billionaires in the world, take all their money, give it to all the people. Within 5 years, they're going to have it back. Because they understand it's the wisdom, innovation, and talent that expands the money flow.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah, and see,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I see that in sales all the time and in business all the time. The ones who are successful, they understand exactly what you just said. And these cute little things we hear all the time, like the average millionaire has been broke 3.5 times because they're willing to take the risk to go out there and follow their dream. They're willing to take the risk to go out there and say, I can do good. I can provide something for people that'll change the way the world works or to change how people live, including myself and the benefits that come from that. I think one of the most wise things I ever heard about money is when I was speaking to my 16-year-old daughter, Antonia, and I said to her, Antonia, let me ask you a question. Do you think that money is the root of all evil? Do you think that if people have money that they're greedy? Because I wanted to see what she said, you know, at 16 years old. She goes, Dad, she goes, it's not the money. If you have it, the question is, what are you going to do with it? I'm like, darn, all right. It's a very proud moment for me. And I'm like, and that's really what it comes down to is that, you know, what are your intentions going into business? What are your intentions going into relationships with people, professionally, even personally, as it may be? And the intentions that you go in to those situations where they're going to determine what you get out of it. The money and success, as we typically define it in an economic culture that we have, is going to find its way to you one way or another, depending on your version of what it means to be successful. But wealth only comes when you're free from the attachment of financial success and possessive success, because when you're not, you always want more to feel wealthy. So when you have more as a reward for pursuing what you're passionate about and providing value to others, you'll always have wealth and finances. When you don't have that clarity, you may have the finances, but you won't have the wealth because you're never going to feel like you have enough.
And, you know, isn't that kind of the selfishness of the world? We think it's all about the money instead of about the quality of life.
Well, yeah, I think it goes back to the six human needs again. I think people want certainty. They want control. I think people, particularly in the past, say, 10 or 15 years, maybe longer, they don't feel confident. They don't feel certain. They feel unsure. And let's face it, I mean, it's kind of funny in a way because I think it was a comedian, Daniel Tosh, who says, they say money can't buy happiness, and that should end with just kidding. Money buys a wave runner. Have you ever seen an unhappy person on a wave runner? And ha, ha, ha. And it's cute. And it's funny. But, you know, the thing is that money gives people a false sense of security. Because what's happening is they're abandoning what really matters for what they think they need. But what they need is predicated on what they've purchased or what they've put in their mind that they need to feel good about themselves. You know, what kind of vehicle do you need to feel good about yourself? Well, the one that gets you where you need to go so you don't have to walk as far so you're not as tired. And it sounds oversimplistic. Are you saying that if I have a Mercedes that I'm selfish? No. I'm saying when you're attaching your level of success to a Mercedes and to the extent that you will sacrifice relationships, ethics, things of that nature for that possession, then you might want to take a look in the mirror. But no, have a Mercedes, have a big house, have all those things. But then also ask yourself, do you also have a propensity to give to others, to share to others, to feel like, wow, I've made it and I'm grateful and I am abundant and I know that even if I was to lose it all, I can make it all back. And I'm not going to hold on to it and hoard it like Ebenezer Scrooge before he had the three ghosts visit him and think that there's no way someone's going to take this from me. Because in reality, it was never yours to begin with. You're borrowing it to see what you can do with it. Because when you're gone, it doesn't go with you. So everything that you have and everything that you are is defined and determined by the choices you make with what you got. Because when you're gone, your story is left behind. The kind of story it's going to be is up to you.
And that's very true. But something come to me, and I want to ask you this. When a country lowers their education system,
mm-hmm.
it soon becomes broke. Do you feel that?
Well,
or impoverished?
You could see clearly that the education system, and, you know, I want to expand that. I mean, just not so much the schools. Because I bet you there's a lot of teachers out there that are really trying hard. They're working with what they got. We also have an education system that's predicated on, and to a certain extent, it's necessary, but to a certain extent, it's not the pedagogical approaches. So, you know, we got to learn the alphabet. We got to learn our basic math and so on and so forth. But it gets to a point where it's about right or wrong. It's not about creative thinking. It's not about innovation. It's about do what I say, be where I say, talk when I tell you to talk. In fact, they've done studies that clearly indicated that a teacher will ask 82 questions to every one asked by a student, which is great if you're doing a multiple choice test, you're being told what to do, and you're being evaluated on that. But your ability to expand the economy, contribute to society, is not going to be predicated on being a robot, on having the right or the wrong answer all the time. You're going to have to go outside the box. And usually, and if you study, anybody studies history, and you look at the people who have been the most successful, they weren't always the best students. You know, they, in fact, many of them dropped out. Many of them, you know, Michael Dell left college. I mean, you could see examples of history of people that did not follow the path. So going back to the original question, without doing something to help our children educationally and also in the home get a more solid foundation of who they are, of expanding the right brain and not just the left brain, of being more confident, all that, the country in itself and the people within it are always going to have challenges. Because for the people that are older, it's much more difficult for them to make those changes. It's much more difficult because their brain has been hardwired to believe a certain thing in a certain way. So what we continue to see is a perpetuation of the same cycle of basically turning people into drones. And I know that sounds harsh, but it's like a lot of people are like, you're told what to like, what not to like. You're told constantly through marketing that you're not good enough, that you don't have the right clothes, you don't have the right car, you don't have enough money, you don't live in the right house. And when you're in school, you're told the same thing. You know, no one hangs a Johnny C on the refrigerator. If he comes home with four A's, a B, and a C, mom and dad typically go, what'd you get the C for? Not, hey, that's fantastic, you got the four A's. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's integrated into that. And I think the problem is, and you can even go into the whole, well, we pay our athletes this much, but we only pay our teachers this much. And it's not so much just the pay, because the teachers know what the pay is when they get into it. It's the whole system. And it's the whole focus on realizing just how important it is to educate the kids. And by the way, you know, I would love to see that, but for people like you and me and the jobs that we do, we're really picking up the pieces where it failed the system for the children growing up.
You know, in my books, I write them with bigger words, and I make it the new words and stuff like that in them. You know,
mm-hmm.
what's funny is I have grown-ups that tell me they don't understand them. I got an 8-year-old niece that does.
Are you there?
That just kind of blowed me away when my 8-year-old niece could tell me she understood them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, why not? I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Congratulations. And the thing is when they're young, this is the danger zone, exactly what your point is that you can see through your niece the capacity that children really have. And so what we fill them with, they're sponges. And if we fill that sponge with dirty water or tainted liquid of any kind, that's what's in that sponge for a long time. And so we have to really take the responsibility, I think, not just in the schools, but as a society, to realize that what the kids see on TV, what they see between mom and dad at home. And let's face it, I mean, in reality, if you're a child today, it's hard because you got both parents working, and even with both parents working, they're not meeting the bills. You know, so you see the stress, and then they don't spend the same kind of time that they used to spend back in the day. I mean, I had time with my parents back in the day, and it just doesn't exist as much anymore. And thank God for the children and the families where it does. There's just a lot of people out there that are struggling, and the kids see it, and then that's what becomes their reality.
Go ahead, finish.
They go to school, and it just perpetuated even more. So they're at home, and it's not working. Then there's pressure at school. It's a real hard life, and a lot of parents don't realize. You know, kids, you know, they get up early every day, and they're working, and they're training their brain, being told what to do. Sometimes they have athletics. There's the social and the peer pressure. They got hours of homework coming home, and you know, the parents say, you're in school, and there's. But they don't realize how much the kids are actually trying to figure themselves out, trying to figure out, am I good enough or not? Am I smart enough or not? Where do I belong? And if the parents don't have the time for them when they come home, that just continues to exacerbate the confusion they sometimes can get at school in terms of who they are and what they want to do.
You know, when I grew up, when I was young, there was nothing open on Sunday except gas stations and restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, I think we should go back to that because – my mom had one rule. If you missed Sunday dinner, you better have been working, or it would have been better to be on the other side because it was bad when you got home.
Yeah.
Because that was family time, was that dinner.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And now you'll see people on their phones constantly. I think one of the comedians I heard said, you know, people are more likely to forget their keys than their phone when they go to the car. And, you know, we all say they're not phones, they're personal communication devices. Get the phone that fits you. Oh, my God. They're going to attach it to our ear at some point. And it's funny. I mean, all the things, the people on the apps and the games. I'm not saying technology isn't great and that it can't be leveraged and there's some cool things that you can do with it. But it's starting to replace human interaction. It's starting to replace the communication that we have with each other.
That's very true. Dennis, we're out of time. We could go probably for 4 or 5 hours. So we're going to have Dennis back. But I want everybody to pay attention to what Dennis was saying. I want you to hear how crisp and how enunciated his voice was and how clear he was on his answers and the way he articulated his wisdom to you. So if you choose and you see a way to expand your life through Dennis's Life Camp coaching, it's life-camp.com. You can see a way to expand your life. And you can get... they can contact you right off the website, right, Dennis?
Yeah, absolutely. You can, everything you need will be on that site. That's our event site, but it's got all the contact information you need. And let me just say, it's been an honor to be on tonight. I've been following you for a long time online, as you know, and you're one of the good ones, sir, and people are lucky to have you out there.
Well, thank you, and I've really enjoyed this. We're going to have Dennis back probably in February because we touched on the school system, and that's something that's close to my heart because that's where we really have to start expanding the world because it's the kids in school today that are going to teach the grown-ups where to go.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if you want world peace, take the grown-ups, put them away, and let the kids play for a year. We'll have world peace.
I'm all for it. Let's do it.
Yeah, me too. Dennis, thank you very much, and all the listeners. I really appreciated this, and I really enjoyed it. And I want to say goodnight to everybody, and a Merry Christmas. And everybody have fun. Thanks, Dennis, and all the listeners.
God bless. Thank you so much.
You betcha.